your host, Lydia Mackay, physiotherapist and super enthusiastic, mostly excited all the time, a runner. And I'm so excited, as always, that you are here. I should say I'm grateful. I'm incredibly grateful that you are here and listening because, guys, today's episode is a banger, as always. You're going to learn heaps about food and how you can fuel your running and how you can optimize performance and just generally enjoy running more, because when you fuel well, you can enjoy your workouts even more. And obviously, that can lead to better performance, which obviously, who doesn't like PBs, right? But before we get into that, if you're new here, welcome. Thanks for joining. Hopefully you're excited to learn something and also just, you know, enjoy good run chats, because for the most part, Soph and myself, Soph being my co-host and co-producer, we just like to chat about running, and we also like to run, and we also like to read about running. Most of our lives revolve around running. Now, Sophie Lane sadly is not joining us today because she is shredding on the slopes at Perisher, and I heard a rumor that she was actually shredding on the Black Run. So if you guys know anything about snowboarding or skiing, which I don't, I'm going to tell you, I believe that the Black Run is quite advanced. Now, I'm just laughing at myself because it's quite embarrassing. I really just don't know anything about skiing. I've been once. Anyway, not important. This is not a show about skiing. So Sophie Lane, sorry, you were canceled. But enjoy the snow, have fun, all those good things. And you guys can listen to Sophie Lane next week on her solo episode. So today is our episode with a guest, which happens every alternate week. If you're new here, this is why I'm just giving you the context. And every other week is a solo episode where we deep dive into some sort of specific topic, often around coaching and getting into running, which Sophie Lane usually chats on as she is a S&C coach and a run coach. And usually my solo episodes are about some sort of injury, because I just am the queen of injuries, both managing them as a physiotherapist and also having them, as it turns out. But last week I chatted all about why runners get injured and what we can do about them and what are the common mistakes that I see in rehab. So hopefully you guys listened to that already, but if you're new here, go and scroll back through the archive and check it out. And obviously all the other episodes, which, you know, are pretty fantastic, if I might say so myself. Anyway, guys, moving on. Obviously, we don't have the wonderful Sophie Lane here. So normally before our episodes, we just have a good chat. Sophie Lane tells us about her week, and then I tell you about my week, and then we have some good old reflections and chat about ways that we can improve. But instead of chatting to Sophie Lane, you're just going to hear me ramble for probably the next 7 minutes, and then you get to listen to the wonderful Aiden the dietitian, who is an absolute wealth of knowledge, and there is just so many practical takeaways from today's episode. So if you're not interested in hearing about my injuries and my takeaways, then you can skip and I'll pop the time stamp in the show notes below. But anyway, guys, what has been happening? I'm going to give you a little bit of an update on Sophie Lane. To be honest, Sophie Lane sent me this long audio message and she was running. Sophie Lane audio always audio messages me when she's running. And to be fair, I do the same to her. But guys, all I can hear is the bloody wind and her talking about something about her calf, something about her hamstring, something about her Achilles. And all I can hear is like of the wind. And I'm like, Soph, I can't hear anything you're talking about. So I just replied, I was like, look, Soph, I am glad that you updated me, but I just did not hear any of that. So all I know is that Sophie Lane has been doing more calf raises lately, as she should, and she has recently implemented doing her calf raises over the edge of a step, which previously she was not, because she was worried about flaring up her Achilles, which was an old injury, but now she's been doing them over the edge of the step. So that's really good of Soph, and she's feeling the effects, she's feeling the burn, so very proud of her. Hopefully it doesn't limit her performance as she shreds on the Black Runs down in Perisher. Okay, enough about Sophie Lane. I'm going to give you guys a little injury update on myself. Last week, I was telling you about my hamstring, how I did some hill sprints, and my hamstring felt really good. And then a couple days later, it kind of flared up. And I'm pretty much putting that down to some change in position, or like slight change in technique in how I was performing my Romanian deadlifts at the gym, and then just bumping up the weights again. And I think when I was doing the deadlifts in that slight different position and heavier weight, I also wasn't warmed up. So
not great on that, which that's exactly how I injured it in the first place. So I don't know why I did that. I need to just get better at that, get better at taking my own advice. And then I was also telling you guys about my hip, which there's no change. It's still there. It's still hanging around. But I'm starting to get in the hang of not pissing it off. So not doing deep squatting, not doing deep lunging, and just like strengthening all the muscles around my hip. So working on my hip adductors, which have been neglected for a long time. So I've been doing my Copenhagens. And if anyone knows about the Copenhagen, holy moly, you will know that it is such a hard exercise. I reckon Copenhagens have to be one of my least favorite exercises. Everything about them I find challenging. Anyway, doesn't matter. If you guys don't know what I'm talking about, Google it, Copenhagen, and yeah, experience it for yourself. I think there's some normative data on that. I think you should be able to hold it for like 40 seconds, and that is in the research as like a good number for a runner. Now, guys, I can definitely hold it for 40 seconds. So why is my hip hurting? I don't know, but we're going to get to the bottom of it. And hopefully in 2 weeks time, I'm going to be able to tell you guys that I've sorted it out and I'm on the money. I'm getting it better. But my most current injury, because, you know, there's always a few little bits and bobs floating around, is I am actually taking a whole week off running. Yep, you heard it here first, guys. Lydia is having a whole week off. Now, I'm only 2 weeks back after having a deload week, or like 2 weeks into the next cycle or whatever. That makes me sound like I take my running structure very seriously, and I don't really from like a performance perspective. I take it seriously from an injury prevention perspective, because I did have a stress fracture a few years ago, or a year ago, oh no, like 2 years ago now, and I'm very diligent about taking deload weeks and rest weeks so that I don't break down and I just get stronger and healthier and all those wonderful things which we want as runners and humans. But I've decided to take an early or extremely premature rest week, and instead of just like deloading just during a few runs, I'm actually not running at all, because I actually think I have some very, very early stage bone stress on my fifth metatarsal, which I almost wasn't going to say anything, because I just know once you say it, it's out there, and I'm like, is that my confirmed diagnosis? Like, I don't want to say that yet, because it's so nice having your head in the sand and just like, you know, not thinking about it and just pushing it to the side and being like, oh, it's just a little bit of something. But basically after my long run on Sunday, I had this sort of lateral foot pain, which I've had this peroneal in the past. And so when this like lateral foot pain popped up most recently, I was like, oh, it must be the peroneal again. But I had a bit of a feel around the outside of my foot and realized that I had no pain around the peroneal, and actually had this one localized tender spot on my fifth metatarsal. And I was really surprised. I was like, oh, that is not where I thought I had the pain. Like, I obviously just am not that in touch with myself or in touch with my feet, and like just didn't quite, like just hadn't really ignored it because, sorry, hadn't paid attention to it truly, because the pain was like a 0.2 at the most out of 10. So it was like just a tiny little bit of an achiness. I noticed that foot just didn't have as much power, and I realized that I was landing quite flat-footed on that side to sort of, well, now that I'm sort of putting it all together, it's kind of just avoiding landing more on my forefoot, which naturally I do land a bit more on my forefoot. And that foot, I just was sort of struggling to get into that position because, as it turns out, it was actually quite painful to land like that, whereas landing flat is fine. So anyway, basically I'm having a very like put the brakes on, let's nip this in the butt. Sash, guys, question. Is it nip this in the butt or nip this in the bud? If you're my patient and said this, I was laughing on the inside. Somebody said, I've got this niggle, blah, 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 and I really want to nip it in the bud. And in my head, I was laughing my head off because I was like, what is going on? Nip it in the bud? Bud? Like, what is the bud? Is that what it's been? Has it always been nip it in the bud? I have no idea. I thought it was nip it in the butt. Like, I don't know. Anyway, guys, basically, I'm trying to be extremely cautious about my foot. I normally wear Vivos every day. I walk barefoot a lot. Like, I love being in the ocean. So most of the time, I'm not in shoes unless I'm at work. And even then, I take my shoes off sometimes. And I have basically been wearing my joggers now the last 2 days. and I'm not going to run. I'm going to just do some gentle walking. I did like, oh my goodness, guys, I did 20 minutes on the rower this morning and 20 minutes on the bike. And it's just not quite the same as running. Also, my glutes hurt when I row. Like, what is the deal with fatiguing glutes when you're on the rower? If anyone knows, let me know. But anyway, basically, pain is so mild. But after my long run, I just could hardly hop because it was that sore, which is not a good sign. As a physio, if there's any physios listening, you'll be like, Lydia, if you can't hop, then you've got some bone stress. But we're trying not to be too dramatic. I think that we just need to do some hardcore resting. And so that's going to be my next week. And then I'm going to return to running on Runner's Christmas, which is City to Surf, coming up in just over a week's time. So I'll do a little test out, shake out run mid next week, and then resume all things, or all systems go, as they say, for good old City to Surf. So I think, honestly, guys, it's just the perfect taper in disguise. So watch out. Lydia Mackay is coming at you, City to Surf.
Hello. Hello. Thank you, Lydia, for the fantastic intro. I'm not sure at what point this is being inserted into the episode, but I'm happy to be included. It feels very strange looking at a blank screen without chatting to you, Lydia, but I hope you're well, and I hope all of you listeners are well as well. So many wells. I'm currently at the snow, living my best life, shredding, getting amongst the powder and the what else, what other lingo is there? Not sure. I'm a bit of a rookie, to be honest. But I am improving as the days go on. And yeah, I'm enjoying it. I've been out for a couple of runs around Jindabyne while I've been here around the lake, which is nice and flat. It's kind of cold, but not as cold as I thought, which I wasn't quite prepared for. I only brought long sleeve running tops, and they're proving to be quite warm. Although, thank you, Lydia, for the MacPack Merino, 100% Merino recommendation, because I wore that on the slopes all day and then went for a run in it. And then wore it again today, and it is smelling fresh as roses, fresh as daisies, the freshest ever. So I'm so amazed, because I know Lydia had been saying about this merino thing, and I was like, oh, I don't believe it. Like, I just think, surely if you're sweaty and you get smelly, it's not, it's just, how could that just vanish? But it's real. So shout out to MacPack. Hopefully we get sponsored soon, because we keep plugging them. But yeah, that's going well. Outfit choices are successful. Body's feeling okay. Just generally quite lethargic and tired after 7 or 8 hours on the slopes, which, you know, I was thinking about, it's like you're just in a quarter squat for like so long. So yeah, really tough on the body, but nice to have a bit of a different stimulus, you know, kind of a different type of impact. And yeah, really enjoying myself. But apart from the snow, what else can I talk about? Today's episode, I'm sure Lydia will do a fantastic job of introducing our guest. I'm a little bit unprepared. I feel like I'm on holiday mode, so I don't even know what's going on, but I do know we spoke to Aiden, the dietitian, in this episode, and I learned a lot, as I often do with the nutrition episodes, because it's definitely not my practice, definitely not my forte. So I really enjoyed speaking to Aiden and learning lots about his lead up into Gold Coast Marathon, which seems like forever ago now, but at the time it was very relevant. We're just getting too organized with our episodes, guys. We are so ahead of the time. So much so that we thought this episode was good to go, all ready, done and dusted. And then a few days ago, Lydia said to me, oh, we haven't recorded the intro, and I am away with no microphone, so hopefully this audio sounds okay. Anyway, hence, here we are. So yes, we had some lovely listener questions. I'm so sure Lydia will fill you in on the rest. In terms of my running, I did about 60Ks last week. I'm about 40-ish at the moment, and it's Friday, so I will probably get maybe 55 in. I thought that this week would be kind of a full deload. Like, I didn't think I'd be running much at all, but so far I've squeezed a few in, so that's been really good. I'm trying to think what's coming up. City to Surf. So when this is out, yeah, next week, City to Surf. So that's next weekend. What else is coming up? We've got an episode with Dan Kavanagh the following weekend. You'll have an episode with me on the City to Surf day. Maybe I'll just do like a pump up City to Surf, get everyone hyped. Do like a little race prep chat, maybe. And then we're into September, which is a marathon. I've officially signed up for marathon as well. Update for everyone. It's locked in. It's ready to go. It's happening. I don't know how it's going to be happening. I did 20Ks continuously last week. Continuously? No, a few breaks. I know that I could physically run 42Ks, but I just don't know what sort of damage I'm going to do. I know Lydia was, I was telling this to Lydia, and she was like, oh, no, like, you should be right. Or I can't actually remember what she said. But basically, I know that I can do it. I just don't know what damage it's going to do and how my body will pull up, specifically my hamstring. But it's all been feeling okay. So we'll see how the next few weeks go. I think it's like 5 weeks from now. So it's kind of a game time. Like, this should be the peak. Tapering should be happening very soon. But I think I'll have a pretty small taper because I haven't had much of a load to recover from. You know what I mean? Anyway, I think that's all from me for now. Thank you so much for editing this in, Lydia. Thank you so much to the listeners. Don't forget to check out our codes below for some discounts. And, oh, big news. I can't believe I nearly forgot. Pace Athletic Run Club in Crow's Nest is starting next Thursday. Thursday the 10th, 6:30 p.m. in Crow's Nest. Myself and Mitsu are going to be leading the run, and I'm so excited to have you all join us. Regardless of where you live, make the commute, get there, Pace Run Club. We're going to have some dinner and drinks afterwards. And we're going to do like just an easy 5K because City to Surf is on that weekend. So just a nice, chill, chatty, social run. And then from every week on from there, we're going to be meeting Thursday, 6:30 p.m. Crow's Nest, Pace Athletic Run Store. Run Store? What's it called? Run Club. Okay, see you all there. Thank you so much and catch you in the next one.
All right, that will do, team, for all the updates for me. You guys have heard enough. I think I'm going to get on to today's episode, which is with Aiden, the dietitian, who is the founder and owner of Ideal Nutrition. And if you guys have checked out Aiden's Instagram, you will just absolutely be loving life because Aiden has got so much content on there, so valuable for anyone who loves to train in the gym, anyone who loves running, because he just breaks down all these complex things and makes them super simple. He's got heaps of nice infographics with pictures and snack ideas and snack suggestions and meal ideas, meal suggestions, and it's just so awesome. So I followed Aiden on Instagram for so long and just always would save his content, like, oh, that's so good. Oh, save that. But I will admit that just because I save a lot of his content doesn't mean I actually applied that many of Aiden's tips. And I'm going to be honest with you guys, since listening to this episode or since recording with Aiden, I've actually adjusted quite a few things. Now, I'm really proud of myself because I had a lot of barriers with implementing some of the intra-fueling stuff and pre-run fueling because I always have this fear that I'm going to upset my tummy. But Aiden talks about that fear and says, I mean, you'll listen to the episode obviously, but he tells us that that sort of gut upset is something that we can actually train. And it was really empowering listening to him say that because it's something that I've always been told that you can train it, but I never really thought I was that capable. I was like, oh, I seem to have the most upset tummy. Like, I'm that runner. I'm the one, like, I'm going to put my hand up a minute. I'm the one who knows where all the bathrooms are on the run because I feel like if I eat anything wrong, I'll just feel so sick on a run and I feel nauseous. I have to run to the bathroom. Like, it is just not a pretty sight. So I always prefer to have less. Like I say, less is more. Like, I'll deal with being a bit dehydrated, a bit, famished, and just like have a good meal when I get home. But Aiden just explains how important it is for our performance. And he's like, why would you not train that when it can improve our performance? And research has shown time and time again how carb loading and intra and pre-run fueling can improve our performance. And something that he pointed out, which I thought was really cool, is that basically, or just about everyone underdoes it. And obviously you guys are going to listen to this episode and obviously, and again, I'm giving you a bit of a spoiler, but I just think this will make you even more excited to listen. So something that he said was that a lot of people just think that one gel is like, cool, I can take one gel an hour. I've done it. Like, I can fuel in my runs. Cool, go me. But he was telling us that the elite athletes are taking like 90 to 130 grams of carbs per hour, which is huge. Like, most gels have got 15 to 20, maybe some have got 30 grams of carbs. And he's like, why the heck would you stop at one? Like, if you can learn to consume one, then consume two, then consume three. Now, Aiden probably didn't put it quite like that. He was a bit more eloquent than I. But anyway, guys, there is so much in this episode. So obviously, as I've alluded to, we've spoken about carb loading. We've spoken about carbs pre and intra, and then obviously post-fueling. And we spoke about that whole dilemma of high-calorie food versus whole foods and sort of the issues that people have around long-term health implications, particularly with metabolic conditions, things like diabetes and all those things that seem to appear when we have like high sugar diets and processed diets. And he sort of dispelled some myths around that. He also brought up something that I hadn't thought of, which was tooth enamel and our teeth health. So that was something really interesting. And of course, we get to speak about caffeine, which is my favorite topic. It was just more incentive for me to keep consuming as much coffee as I possibly can because I love it. I think it's fantastic. And Aiden thinks it's fantastic as well. We talk about gut health, digestion, recovery strategies, and then also about Aiden's prep for Gold Coast Half Marathon, which obviously was a few weeks ago now, or maybe a month ago. And Aiden competed back then. So when we recorded, it was just before that. But this sort of stuff is going to be helpful if you're prepping for any race, and in particular, Sydney Marathon's coming up. So maybe that'll be helpful for you as well. We also spoke about like post-run, when you should eat and how quickly you should eat, fasted cardio, fasted running, and fat burning. Oh, that's something that we spoke on a little bit, and it's something that we could definitely spend more and more time chatting on, but definitely some interesting information there. And then we also just spoke about adaptation of the gut and, you know, training to consume more calories and what happens then for longer events and how our body might use different fuel sources. So super interesting episode, guys. I'm so excited for you to listen, and I better stop talking now so you can actually get on and listen to it. Thank you as always for supporting the podcast team. Soph and I absolutely love bringing this to you, and we are so stoked to have so many wonderful active listeners. We get some lovely messages on Instagram and some lovely reviews that come through. So thank you so much for the support. It really means the absolute world. And if you're not following us on Instagram, guys, find us there at Stronger Stride. Send us a message, say hello, tag us on Instagram wherever you are listening, and just keep on enjoying your good running life. Do your strength work, do your calf raises, get your sleep, eat your veggies, all those good things, and hopefully see you at City to Surf. All right, friends, enjoy the episode. Podcast. Today we are very stoked to be joined by Aiden Muir, who is a sports dietitian and founder of Ideal Nutrition, and he is currently training and tapering and probably carb loading for the Gold Coast Half Marathon. Welcome, Aiden.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you, very excited to have an expert on. Soph and I love eating food, and it would be awesome to learn a bit more about how we can optimize that for our running. Bit of a giggle there. So do you not love eating food as much as I do?
I do. No, I love it. It is my favorite activity, second to running. When you can do both of them at the same time, it's even better. Aiden, but if you want to give the listeners a little bit of your backstory, how you got into dietetics and how that journey has been for you, and then obviously a little bit of backstory on your prep towards Gold Coast as well.
Yeah, cool. So how did I get into dietetics? I don't know. I try and keep it brief, but basically I've always been interested in exercise and nutrition. Like, that's always been a thing. And I first went to the gym around year 12. So I would have been like 17 years old. And I was a very skinny kid. I thought I was just going to lift some weights, get jacked, solve all my problems. And it didn't work out that way. I started off skinny and I got skinnier very quickly. Like, I lost 5 kilos in the first 4 weeks.
Wow.
And I was like, what am I doing wrong? So I like hopped on Google and like started reading about nutrition, and clearly I just accidentally ended up in a calorie deficit. And then I just think like lifting just never came naturally to me. Like, it was always just hard to make progress. And that made me start reading more and more about both lifting and nutrition. And then the time came to pick what I wanted to do at university. And I was like, well, I'm spending heaps of time reading about this anyway. I might as well go and formally study this and maybe make a career out of it. So that's how I went down the route of becoming a dietitian. Obviously, I studied that just out of interest, but somewhere along the line, I obviously learned that I like helping people, one-on-one consults, all of those things. And then the running thing just came along, just because like I'd been into running when I was younger, like when I was just in high school, not an elite level or anything like that. It was just something that like naturally I was pretty good at. And then I found lifting and just kind of got obsessed with that for many, many years. Played basketball and a few other sports on the side. But after my last powerlifting comp, my body felt just kind of a bit broken, like knee pain and stuff like that, elbow pain. And I was like, I just want to do something that's not powerlifting for a bit. And like, what's the opposite? Running. Decided to have a crack at that.
Yeah, nice. How long has it been now since you've been more dedicated to the running?
So probably, it's tough. So like I would have started running once a week, maybe like February, so like 4 months ago. And then that crept up to like now four times a week, like maybe 2 months. So it's probably been eight weeks of like four times a week and then just like slowly building up to that.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so relatively fresh then.
Yeah, relatively fresh.
Yeah, yeah, cool. And are you feeling good leading into Gold Coast this weekend?
Yeah, I'm feeling great, to be honest. Like every time I've set goals, like it just seems like I'm going to exceed whatever goal that has been. It's been a good journey. Yeah,
so good.
This is awesome. This is so nice. I feel like so many times the stories that we hear are like, well, probably because I'm a physio, I'm always seeing people who are injured, but it's always like the opposite of like, oh my God, like found running. It was so good. It was so fun. And I went from once a week to twice a week. And now I'm going 8 days because I'm going to go extra. Well, why not? Do that with extra 110%, right? And of course, people usually break. But I imagine that you're going at this new hobby and this training plan with probably a little bit more science behind you, obviously from the nutrition side of it, but probably getting some advice from the right people.
The training. So like honestly, the knee injury was patellar tendinopathy. And like throughout that process, everyone's like, don't increase your load by more than 30% in a single like month or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just took that approach to running. Like the first like few, like I started out like very low volume and just like slowly ramped up volume. And then like the last like 4+ weeks, everything's just felt incredible. And I'm like, it seems no matter what I do, it feels good. So I'm not too concerned about loading now. But for that first stage, like I was like so conservative. I mean, like I had been playing basketball, but I started out running like 2Ks and stuff like that when all my friends were doing like much longer distances.
Yeah, good. I think that's a great approach. I think more people need to start conservative. And I think it's so easy to get caught up in that, you know, when your friends are going further and it's really easy to get carried away, but sounds like you're being really sensible with it, which is exciting. We would love to talk about kind of your carb loading and nutrition approach to the event, but I think before we get too specific into your own prep, if we can go through a couple of kind of topics that come up quite often for our endurance runners when we're looking at their own nutrition. I think to kick us off, if we can talk a little bit about, I guess, kind of the pros and cons between maintaining your weight versus losing weight during the prep leading up to a race. So as you said, when you first started lifting weights, you all of a sudden lost heaps of weight, which you probably weren't intending on doing. You were kind of doing the opposite. and so for some of the runners, they may have that same thing where it's this incidental weight loss that they haven't really thought about. For others, maybe they're thinking that losing weight is going to help their performance. So if you want to just touch on a little bit behind, I guess, the reasons for and against weight loss leading up to something like a half marathon.
So I'll start by working backwards from what I'd say is the ideal scenario. I think the ideal scenario is having your body composition be as good as it could be in the optimal position or whatever, like 2 months out or something like that. And then having like the entire prep like on maintenance calories, maybe even a small surplus in some cases, so that you're fueling well, recovering well from training, adapting, improving, et cetera. That would be the perfect scenario. Obviously, not everyone is in that scenario. Getting lighter in a lot of cases can help running. It can do that to a point. There are situations where doing that would be detrimental. There's heaps of research on this concept called like low energy availability, which is where people are doing heaps of training and they're not eating much food in comparison to the amount that they're training. Comes alongside a lot of downsides. Obviously, ramping up your training very quickly while also trying to be in a large calorie deficit could contribute to that issue. And then also just like not recovering well from training and not adapting well and everything like that. So it's a bit of a fine line. Like, as I said, in some cases, getting lighter will help. In some cases, fueling yourself would help. That's why I kind of talk about that ideal world scenario where it's like, ideally, you slowly work towards that ideal body composition. You don't have many periods of time where you're doing heaps of training and you're in a large calorie deficit. Ideally, you do that calorie deficit, if you do need to get leaner or would benefit from getting leaner, a decent way out from the race, and then have most of the prep being at maintenance calories. The only nuance to that is obviously it's not always an ideal world. Like in some cases, it might be better not to do that approach.
Yeah. And I think as well, would you be able to explain for listeners why that is more the optimal way? Why is being in that maintenance phase for that 8 weeks or 12 weeks, whatever is leading out, why is that better than losing the weight then? What's the kind of risk, I guess, with that?
So there's heaps of examples here. Like one, as I was saying, is even just like fueling yourself, like in terms of like muscle recovery and stuff like that. Like when we are in a calorie deficit, there is a deficit of energy available. The body doesn't have enough calories to go around to fuel all of its basic functions and everything like that. And it's pulling from its own internal stores of either muscle, fat, or glycogen to try and fill that gap, to cover that deficit. And it's kind of hard for the body to be adapting in an optimal way when there is that deficit present. So you can kind of see how that could be a downside. The other thing, like, I won't go too deep down this rabbit hole, but like the low energy availability thing, in some cases, women, if they previously had a regular menstrual cycle, they might lose their period. And then that is also a sign of many other things going on. For example, decreases in bone mineral density and stuff like that, which could lead to stress fractures and everything like that. So people get sick more often as well. And like, obviously you don't want to get sick. Like, rates of like upper respiratory tract infections, like colds and stuff like that, increase when you're training hard, when you're training outdoors. If you're in a state of low energy availability, that increases the likelihood of that occurring, makes it even harder. And then the final thing, which doesn't really fit the category of everything I've just talked about, but like we'll probably get to this concept of like training the gut, like taking on carbohydrates during training so that you could take them on race day, tolerate them well, get the best benefit out of them. Some people, or a lot of people, when they're trying to be in a calorie deficit and reducing their intake of stuff, are very hesitant to be taking on these intra-workout carbohydrates, which could potentially help them on race day as well if they'd practiced it and prepped and trained the gut for that situation too.
Yes, I mean, it really just sounds like you're losing out on a lot of the benefits of training, as well as obviously injury or health risk. Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. I think though a lot of the time people start running because they think they might lose some weight and they think that might be better. Yeah. And it's having a pretty big reason people start running. It seems like a sport of losing weight. Historically, it's probably how it's being sold. But I think they're just so important reasons to consider. And I think probably Sophie and I probably more see the injury side of it and consider like the risk for stress fractures being huge and just any sort of injury if you're not really looking after your body. But yeah, that performance piece makes so much sense.
There's also a study that, like, I don't have it off the top of my head, like the title of the study or anything like that. But I remember reading it being like, this is so interesting, because I've seen a lot of studies like this as well. But one that just stood out to me was like, they got a bunch of runners who were like elite level runners. Obviously, they had relatively good body composition to start off with. And they put them into like an intentional overtraining phase where they just like randomly increase their running volume by 50%. Obviously, they were already running at a high volume because they were training as elite athletes. And they just chucked 50% on top. And one group, they just did no dietary intervention. The other group, they just like made them eat a bunch of carbs, like so many carbs. And I can't remember the exact duration. It was 8 weeks or something like that. But at the end of the 8 week kind of phase, the group that was like forced to eat heaps of carbs actually improved. And the other group obviously got considerably worse. they overtrained and got worse. But it's really interesting just to see that being like, that wasn't the outcome they were trying to find. They weren't actually trying to make them better athletes because they just randomly chucked 50% extra volume. But the group that was like force feeding carbs actually improved their performance. And it's like, what if their training was better? Like, what would have happened then?
Oh my goodness. That's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I guess obviously 8 weeks, it's not a true indicator of like.
Yeah. It wouldn't reflect health. Like year round. Like,
yeah. No. But that's fascinating. That's so cool. And people are often so fearful of consuming extra carbohydrates. So that's fascinating. I'd love to read that. Would you be able to tell us a little bit now about what intrafueling might mean? Because you mentioned a little bit about like practicing how you're going to have race day. But can we talk a little bit about what intrafueling is and why it's important?
So I think this is one, like, now that I'm in the running community, I think this is one of the most underappreciated things. Like, I'd had clients coming to me for years who like had been underdoing this, but I didn't realize like everybody's underdoing this outside of the elite level. Mm-hmm. Basically, carbohydrates glucose is our best fuel source for running. We see this very clearly. We see this by the fact that they call this concept of in a marathon of hitting the wall. We see like race times literally drop off when glycogen stores get to quite a low level. There's quite a clear linkage. So when we look at it from that perspective, it's like, how do we keep those glycogen levels higher? So glycogen is the storage form of glucose. Well, obviously carb loading is one option, having higher glycogen levels to start off with. But another step is like literally taking on carbs as you're running. If you are taking on carbs as you're running and that's getting converted to glucose, it's at least buffering it so that your glycogen levels remain higher for longer. You run out of glycogen later and that will improve performance. The bit where I say it's underutilized is I don't think a lot of people realize like how much you can take on. For context, like straight up glucose, you can take on about 60 grams of glucose per hour. If you use multiple carbohydrate sources like glucose and fructose together, for example, you can get up to about 90 grams of carbs per hour. An Endura energy gel is like 21 grams of carbs. And it's like, if you look at that per hour, it's like, how many gels could you be having per hour? Obviously, it would take, like, the average person can't just jump straight into having like 4+ gels per hour. Like, they'd feel pretty disgusting if they tried that while running, like if they're going as fast as they can. but it is also a trainable quality. Some people can do it better than others, but everybody can improve for whatever level they're at.
And so do most of the energy gels say what they're made of?
They'll have their nutritional information. Yeah.
Okay. And I assume, like, I can't remember what the brand is, but I know there was one brand that used to do like some sort of testing for like each person, and then they'd make up a custom gel with like different types of sugar. Is that something that you recommend or I've heard of? Or
I've never gone down that route. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if that was a thing. Like, the basic summary that a lot of people say is like a 2-to-1 ratio of glucose to fructose is like ideal, but that's also too round of a number. Like, the human body doesn't like work on perfect ratios like that. I've noticed certain sports drinks, like from the top of my head, like I don't think Gatorade isn't exactly 2-to-1 ratio. Like, I think they're like slightly off that ratio. Don't quote me on that, but like certain gels I've seen that are also a little bit off that ratio. And I think there is an average that works best for most people. I wouldn't be shocked if there's individual testing. I just haven't heard of anyone doing that or seen evidence that it's better.
Yeah. So if someone was really set on getting some testing done to like optimize their gel, do you think they're probably focusing their energy on the wrong area?
The only reason I'd say that, and I'm open to being wrong on this, is just because what I'd have to look at is be like, is there evidence that this is better? Like, we see this in a lot of other areas of nutrition, of just being like individualized testing for everything. Like, a different example of this is like testing sweat rates and stuff like that. Like, there is like sweat testing available, but it's also not common practice at the elite level. Some people obviously do it, but it's not common practice because there's not really evidence that it's like leading to better results. Like, are people running faster because they're doing this? If we see consistent evidence of it, it's like, well, everybody should be doing this at this stage then.
So if our goal then is to get kind of as many carbs or as, I don't even know if it's as much or as many, my mom will correct me, she's a speech therapist, per hour, how do we actually practically do that? Do we start with taking one gel an hour and do that on our long run on Sunday, and then the next week do we try two? Like, how do you practically suggest people go about kind of trying to maximize that intake?
Yeah, so that's literally it. Hey, so the first thing I like to start off with is giving people a positive experience. I start low, right? Almost everybody should be able to tolerate like 30 grams in an hour. But I try to make sure everybody has a positive experience. If somebody's got like a really sensitive gut, they feel like they get a lot of issues and everything like that, start at 10 grams. It doesn't matter. Like, let's just get like a positive experience off the bat and then keep building from there. We know that we can improve this. As I said, we can improve in everybody. It's just how far can we get it? Something that, like, although I say like 90 grams is kind of the limit, the best in the world are going over 100 grams. Like, if we look at certain sports like Tour de France, they're having, from what I've seen, around 110 to 120 grams of carbs per hour. We're seeing that, like, trail runners who are doing like ultra endurance, like, we're seeing some of them doing like near that 120 gram mark as well. And even though, like, we see like 90s this like theoretical limit, I think there are just freaks out there. There are people who genetically gifted, really good at taking on this stuff, have like their gut is just really good at tolerating it, and they've practiced and built up to a lot over time. The only reason I chuck that 90 gram number out there is to, one, give people a positive experience, start off with a low amount, and give them something to work towards. Because, like, what you're really trying to do is start an amount that feels okay and then build up to the point. It's like a U-shaped curve where it's like at some point it hurts your performance because it causes gut symptoms. You can't tolerate it well. But build up to a point that you get the best performance without many drawbacks. The reason I chuck numbers out there, though, is because if you get a group of runners and you tell them to do that, most of them work up to like 30 grams of carbs per hour and just kind of stop there. But if they know, oh, there's someone out there that's doing like 90, like, they'll build up to at least 60.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think runners love metrics and numbers and data. So I think that's really helpful. And then I guess from a palatability point of view, especially if we're talking like moving into the ultra distances where people are out there day after day, how do you suggest practically people take these on if they're aiming for that 90 gram and you're saying a hammer gel is about 20, rather than just having four gels, or maybe that's what you suggest, is there a way of them getting it in through multiple different streams? Are there different options outside of the gel that you would go to as kind of some trials that people should
play? So the first point of call is like obviously gels, and then like some form of sports drink, like whether it's Gatorade or a similar, there's so many options out there obviously. And then if from a palatability perspective that becomes an issue, the next step is some form of whole foods, like obviously something that's like super easy to digest. That could be dried fruit, that could be like honey sandwiches. There's so many options, right? One tiny downside of that is that kind of like glucose to fructose ratio thing. Like, ideally gels are like set up to be like optimized so you can take on the maximum amount of carbohydrates per hour. And once you get into the whole foods category, you're kind of moving a little bit away from that. But the other thing is, like, if somebody's like doing 20 plus hours or something like that, like the actually just getting it in is more important than that. Because if somebody just like feels nauseous because they're going back for so many gels after a period of time, we're not really looking at optimizing things. We're just trying to get stuff in at that stage.
And then when we're talking about whole foods, because obviously whole foods are considered healthier and processed things are demonized, especially in diet culture at the moment yeah. and social media. And I think this is something that's come up so many times on different episodes and even just like day-to-day conversation. People who are trying to eat healthy might have an issue with this because
yeah.
you know, it sounds like a lot of carbohydrates or a lot of calories as well. Like it's a very energy dense. It's a processed food, a processed thing that you're consuming. I don't know if you can call it gel food, but it's processed. How would you navigate that conversation with a client? And what would you say to someone who's got concerns around that? Is that something that they should be worried about? Or does that just not apply when you're in a sort of like quote unquote extreme environment where you're running for, you know, several hours or training for a half marathon or whatever it is?
Yeah, so I'll approach that from a few ways. One thing that was a good reminder for me though is like in relation to how often should you be doing this? Should this just be on your Sunday long run or anything like that? I don't have a perfect answer for that. I think for most people, just once a week probably makes sense. So that allows you to kind of balance training your gut, getting used to taking all this on board, getting the performance benefits of it and everything like that without making it take up a large percentage of your overall intake. Maybe twice a week. You could maybe say three times a week. I wouldn't be doing it for every single run. I would be prioritizing it for important sessions, either longer sessions or quicker sessions in terms of more intense, I should say. Once you look at it over the course of the week, you're like, what percentage of my intake is this? Ideally, even as a percentage of your total carbohydrate intake, most of your carbohydrates are coming from nutrient-rich foods and you're getting decent amounts of fiber and everything like that. This is more of just like a performance thing under those specific circumstances. And we very clearly see that it improves performance. Like if we are measuring race times, we are seeing improved performance. So I think that's how I'd kind of navigate it, being like, it is totally fine to be doing that in moderation in terms of your overall weekly intake. Not only is it fine, it literally will make people better athletes, which I think is a simpler way of looking at it.
And are there any long-term health implications of having that every Sunday? Like if that's every Sunday you do your 3-hour yeah. long run, is that going to be an issue at some point?
The simplest one and the most clear-cut one is the health of teeth, like tooth enamel. So yeah, very clearly there is a link between like sugar and like degradation of tooth enamel. When I did a sports dietitian course at the AIS many years ago, I remember that they just made that point, just being like, we don't give this stuff to 15-year-old athletes, because if they're going to be still competing when they're 30 plus, and say they're doing it every session, like say they're having, as an example, Gatorade every single session, that's like 15 years of having high sugar foods regularly. Like it's likely going to cause dental concerns. In terms of other health outcomes, this is probably too big of a topic to kind of cover in this podcast, but sugar in isolation is not really linked with many health outcomes once you account for all of the other variables. If you just looked at a chart measuring sugar intake and health outcomes in terms of chronic disease and everything like that, you would probably see that a higher intake of sugar leads to higher risk of chronic disease. I'm not going to argue against that point. The bit that I was going to focus a bit more on, though, is the fact that sugar is usually linked with higher calorie intake because it's easier to overconsume calories when people are consuming more sugar. And the fact that it comes alongside no micronutrients in most cases if it's added sugar, and it also doesn't come alongside fiber. If you are consuming an appropriate amount of calories for your goals, so you're not gaining a bunch of body fat in the process or anything like that, and you are also focusing on a micronutrient-rich diet overall, and you're focusing on a fiber-rich diet overall, I wouldn't see any concerns with this being linked with any negative health outcomes. I have heard one practitioner talk about something that kind of makes a little bit of sense in terms of like maybe this could have implications for the gut microbiome, particularly if it's done more frequently than that. But once again, I think that would be offset by having a high fiber intake overall, because we see this in other areas. For example, some people point about concerns with higher protein intake and the impact on the microbiome. But when you match it for having high fiber intake alongside that, those concerns basically disappear.
Yeah, I think it's really good to know and probably really comforting for a lot of runners. On the flip side of that, like if we ignore performance and ignore sort of like, if we like, you know, zoom out and think about the whole week and like the positives of having all your whole foods on the other days of the week, is there an issue, or like if someone doesn't care about performance, is there a concern for someone's health? And, you know, Sophie and I probably have our own thoughts around this as well from like an injury perspective, but is there an issue with just not eating anything or not eating much or only having a small amount because you're like, oh, I don't really care that much about performance and I want to mostly eat whole foods, I want to protect my teeth. Like, is that something that you would consider risky? Obviously, we've spoken a little bit about underfeeling, but is there a minimum amount that you'd recommend for people just for like a safety perspective for their general health and I guess risk mitigation?
Yeah, I'd focus more on at least consuming a sufficient amount of calories. Like that's a bit of a no-brainer, consuming a sufficient amount of protein and consuming a sufficient amount of micronutrients overall. In terms of like the sugar specifically, do you mean though?
Yeah, like for a run, like let's say someone's doing a 2 or 3 hour run on the Sunday and they don't consume anything, they have something before, they have something after. If they're doing that every week, is that going to have some long-term health implications?
To be honest, I do think that is fine. Like if they are doing that, like if they are having food before and they're having food after, they're going into that run with like decent glycogen stores. If they've been eating around that and everything like that, they'll run low on glycogen towards the back end. And obviously having carbohydrates throughout would mean they run low later. But my perspective is like, what's the difference between in that specific example between doing that and a 6 hour event or something like that where you're taking on carbs but you're still burning carbs at a quicker rate than you would be taking them on, and you're still going to be in a low glycogen state in that example for a long time anyway. Like I don't see that as too much of an issue if they have eaten before and they're eating after as well.
That's awesome. And that really brings us on to the next part, which we've almost gone in the wrong order, but pre-run fueling, like what should that look like? I assume carbohydrates are important and probably moderate fiber or low fiber intake. What are your thoughts around that, and is there certain timings that you like to adhere to to make sure you can digest it?
So gold standard is always starting with do no harm, don't do things that make you worse. Start with stuff that you know sits well, makes it easy for the run and everything like that. Some people are a little bit too sensitive with that and they're like, oh, do no harm, if I eat stuff it makes me feel terrible when I run. But like we've just got done talking about how there are people having like 90 plus grams of carbs per hour while running. Like I think everybody can have a little bit of food before running. It's just choosing the foods that do sit well and everything like that, and then starting with an amount that is low enough that you can definitely tolerate well, and then increasing from there as needed. So obviously, yes, carbohydrates, that's the starting point. The same reason as everything else being like, if we're having carbs intra-workout to try and like delay glycogen stores from getting too low, same logic. We can have that before to have that same impact. Same thing as if somebody has carb loaded for an event or anything like that. When we're sleeping, our glycogen levels are depleting a little bit. So it's like we have to have this top up in the morning to get them back to 100% as well. So relatively low fiber, relatively low fat. The logic behind those two is that fiber and fat both slow down digestion. That's normally not a bad thing. It's just in the context of if you're about to go run, you probably don't want heaps of fiber, heaps of fat. It might not sit as well. Other stuff, caffeine. If somebody wanted to have caffeine, particularly if it's a morning run, it can have benefits. It can reduce what we call the rate of perceived effort. It makes stuff feel easier and that might make it easier to go a little bit harder. It can literally improve performance by about 1-3% on average if a high enough dosage is used. Obviously, if you went too high, there's going to be downsides as well. But the caffeine benefits on performance, it's kind of hard to tell where it comes from. Some people talk about being like from fat transportation. Some people talk about just simply being that reduced rate of perceived effort allows people to go harder, and maybe that explains it. And there's other mechanisms that are proposed. And a final one, this is a bit of a rogue recommendation out of left field. I don't know if your listeners would be familiar with this, but beetroot juice, like 2-3 hours before a run. Is that something you've ever heard anyone talk about?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, cool. So yeah, just like dilates blood vessels, makes it easier for blood to flow through. This is nitrates that are doing that. And research on like, I guess you'd call like recreational non-elite runners on like 5K runs has shown that people improve their performance by about 1.5% if they do that. So that could be an easy win, particularly for an event. Like, no, I wouldn't do that like every Sunday if you're going out for a run or anything like that. But for an event, like there's not many easier ways to take like 1.5% off your time.
Yeah,
that's huge.
That's massive, isn't it?
Yeah. What are the dosages of that for beetroot juice? And like, does it have to be a specific type of beetroot? Like, can you just buy beetroots and like squeeze the juice? I don't know how it works.
Yeah. So the standard and the easiest way to do it would be a concentrated shot of beetroot juice. So a 70 ml shot. So Beta is the company that does it in Australia. The reason why a concentrated shot makes sense is because it would be somewhere between 500 and 800-ish mils of actual beetroot juice. And it's like, I just like, particularly if you're running in the morning, I'm like, I don't want to have like that much beetroot juice, like, and then go run. So a shot, can you get it through food? Yes, it just takes a lot of vegetables to get there, right? So like, we're once again looking at like closer to the kilo amount of vegetables. And once again, if you're doing that right before a run, probably not a great idea. And you also can't really measure the amount that is in vegetables, whereas I believe could be wrong, but I believe that the Beat It company has like a bit of a guarantee that's going to be around the 300 milligram of nitrate per shot kind of milestone.
And then what about dosages for caffeine? Because I find that something that is a little bit variable in terms of when people like order a coffee, like small, large, double shot, whatever, and then like the coffee that people make at home. And I find that, you know, when I've Googled how much caffeine is in my coffee, and it comes up anywhere between like 50 and 100, 120. Yeah. And I'm like, gosh, like when, you know, how much do we actually need? Because I'm sure when I've read about it, it's actually way more.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I thought it was.
Yeah. So I'll look at this from a few angles. In terms of how much caffeine is in a shot of coffee, I typically say it's around 80 milligrams, with the caveat of a sports dietitian named Ben Desro did a study on the Gold Coast, basically just going around to coffee shops and asking for one shot of espresso and then measuring how much caffeine it contained. And the lowest was around 25 milligrams and the highest was 200. And
oh, whoa.
Those are obviously outliers, and the middle ground is probably closer to that 80 milligrams. But when I tell you like how high you kind of need to go, it might not make sense to do that just through coffee, because that variance, like if you happened to be off significantly, it could cause issues. So in terms of the dosage, like of caffeine that we're looking for, we're looking at around 3 to 6 milligrams per kilo of body weight. So do the math on that. I'm just going to use 100 to make it like 100 kilos to make it really simple to start off with. So like that's 300 to 600 milligrams for somebody who's 100 kilos. Obviously we can work backwards from that based on whatever the listener's body weight is. It's quite a bit. Obviously, if we're looking at one shot of coffee, being 80 milligrams, I've widened the range to 3 to 6 because there's a bit of nuance here. 1 to 3 is enough to reduce rate of perceived effort. That 5 to 6 definitely, but maybe sometimes 3 to 6 is enough to definitely to improve performance. There are exceptions. If somebody, like if it makes them need to go to the bathroom while they're running, like then obviously it's not going to help performance. If somebody gets a lot of anxiety and caffeine upregulates that anxiety, it's not going to help performance. And if somebody gets like super jittery or their heart rate increases, it's not going to help performance. So it's a very individual thing. I say to a lot of people, the science, like I say that like 3 to 6 or 5 to 6 milligrams per kilo, but then I think we just try and get this U-shaped curve once again, where it's like too little, you're not getting all the performance benefits, too much, it causes issues. And the final thing I'd say on that, even though I've just listed a bunch of stuff, is this concept of caffeine tolerance is very nuanced, probably exists. But if you go above your normal intake, like say you go like 30% above the normal amount, like if somebody is listening to this and they're like, I do 5 to 6 milligrams per kilo every day. If you went up to like 7 or maybe even 8, you'd still get similar benefits to the average person who doesn't have anywhere near the amount of coffee going up to that 5 to 6 milligram mark I was talking about.
Yeah, interesting. And what about when it comes to those ultra distances again? So if someone's doing a multiple day event, or even 24 hours or something like that, should they be supplementing the caffeine throughout the run as well as before, or how does that work?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm not even sure if like research has really optimized this yet, but one thing that's really interesting is that dosage I just talked about was like pre-workout, obviously. So like takes caffeine like 30 to 60 minutes to peak in your blood. So if you just have like 30 minutes before a run, makes sense pre-workout. But one of the more interesting things that research has found is that little top-ups of caffeine help improve performance. So a lot of athletes have said this for years, like everyone tells stories about like flat Coke improving performance more than you would expect from just the sugar in Coke. And Well, the research kind of like dismissed that, being like, that's only 40 milligrams of caffeine. Like that's nothing. Like for like the equivalent of a can of Coke, I should say, 375 mils would be 40 milligrams of caffeine. And most researchers were kind of like, that's not really enough to get what we need out of it. And that research then did get done, and it improved performance. And it, to the best of my knowledge, it improved performance around as much as a higher dosage of caffeine. Once you get to that like ultra, like really long distance stuff, that's where I'm like, I don't know where the optimal protocol comes into play, being like, do you just continuously do top-ups through the entire event and you get the same benefits? Like, I think that it's such a niche space that's mm-hmm. very hard to study what the optimal protocol would be. But at minimum, I would be doing top-ups throughout the event.
Yeah, because I guess there's that sleep deprivation element as well when it comes to that. So you'd imagine that, yeah, frequently topping that up is going to be helpful just to stay awake, let alone improving performance.
100%.
Hopefully there's more research coming out of that, because it's definitely a growing area. Cool. All right. So that was caffeine. We've talked a little bit about what you're having before the event, but if we can take it back maybe a couple of days leading up, maybe 24, 48, 72 hours prior, what does that carb loading actually look like practically? Should everyone be doing it? And how does it change, I guess, depending on what sort of distance or duration your event is?
Yeah, great. So in terms of duration of event, anything that's over 90 minutes, you should probably carb load for if you're trying to optimize performance, okay? And the less frequent events get, the more this matters as well. What I mean by that is if somebody's like doing a triathlon every weekend or every second weekend, it's like, would you carb load for that? Like at some stage, it's probably not a good idea if it's that frequent. But for less frequent events, it makes sense. How to go about doing it? The protocol is actually really simple. I'll talk numbers in a second, but it's a really high amount of carbohydrate for 1 to 2 days before the event. There have previously been a lot of more complex protocols where people try to deplete their glycogen stores. Maybe they do an intense workout to really fully be depleted, and then it allows the body to supercompensate and go slightly higher than what we can get with just that 1 to 2 days, but it just hasn't improved performance. And it's also a bit weird to do this like perfect taper and then do an intense workout just to get this like super compensation. That's probably part of why it hasn't improved performance. But just 1 to 2 days, the standard number I chuck out there is 10 to 12 grams per kilogram of body weight carbs per day. So let's go back to that 100 kilo number, keep it simple. That's like 1,000 to 1,200 grams of carbs. That's an obscene amount. Most people, like a lot of people, might be lighter or they might be larger than that. Obviously, do the maths on that in relation to yourself. The reason why I said the number I often chuck out there is 10 to 12 is we store glycogen in our muscles. So if somebody happens to be at a higher body fat percentage than the average, say, marathon runner, then we'd actually scale it to a lower number. Like I've seen some people say as low as like 6 to 8 grams per kilogram. Like if somebody was using an example above 30% body fat, I'd say like 7 to 8 grams per kilogram of body weight would make a bit more sense than 10 to 12. But as I'm sure you've probably seen me post on social media, the average person does not get anywhere near this number if they carb load without making a formalized plan where they track out their carbohydrate intake. Most people get to around 5 to 6 grams per kilogram body weight carbs per day of that phase. And that's not something I've got a source for. Like I don't have a study that's like measured that. That's just like what I have seen, what I've heard experts in the space say. And it makes sense when you see how people go about it. And the reason that happens is for a few reasons. One is people are scared to eat the amount of carbs it takes. Two, it's just a lot of carbs. Like every time I do carb loading plans for athletes, I like write out what I think it's going to look like. And then I do the maths and I was like, oh, damn it. I've undershot again. I need to add more. Like, there's even on our blog, we have like a carb loading protocol, and Tyler, who works with me, is the one who wrote this one. And you can see at the end, he's just like, he's done the same thing. And he's like, and as another snack somewhere throughout the day, add in this. Like, cause it just didn't fit into the plan. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot. And the final reason I was going to say is that most people will get too full or feel uncomfortable before they reach the amount of carbs. And the trick to trying to prevent that is a few things. One is not going obscenely high fiber. If you typically use your normal carbohydrate sources that gives you a decent amount of fiber on a daily basis and you just like had way more of that, you'd end up with a huge amount of fiber. Fiber is obviously indigestible, so that like it's just not going to go downward. Most people get like gut upset or just feel full pretty quickly. The other one is keeping protein and fat not overly high. Maybe protein moderate or even low if you want to. Fat definitely low. And you can see how like if somebody's like, oh, I'm carb loading, I'm going to have pizza as an example, fat would get quite high. And then that's not an issue in isolation. It's just the fact that it raises calories. Every gram of fat has 9 calories per gram. Every gram of carbs has 4 calories per gram. If you have a lot of fat, you're just going to end up with so many calories that you're going to get full before you finish that.
Yeah. Wow. Have you got any, I guess, examples of foods that would be relatively high carb and kind of low volume that aren't super filling, but still quite dense in carbs, or is it just a matter of eating lots?
So the simplest and the easiest starting point is liquid calories. It is easier to drink than it is to eat. The next step is to not be afraid of sugar for this phase as well. Like the classic example that so many people use is like literally getting an entire bag of lollies. Like I'm talking like 170 to 220 grams of lollies. I assume you guys would have seen, or you did share it actually. So you shared like the carb loading thing that I did as my example. Mm. And for context, that was 800 and something grams of carbs. And it came out as about 350 grams of sugar, which is quite high for me. Like that's very high for me. And one of my employees was like, just wondering, is that what you're actually going to do? Because I think you need to go higher sugar than that. Like, I just don't know if you're going to be able to get it all in if you don't go higher sugar than that.
Wow.
So often high sugar foods make it easier to get it in.
Mm. Gosh, it's so fascinating. And for someone like there's so much like almost emotional burden around sugar. And like, I feel like that word in society is just like this terrible word. And it's just used so much. And it's almost frustrating because we'll always have this story about how like evil and addictive and dangerous it is. Like what would you say to someone who had concerns about having that much sugar for a couple of days? Like, is there an issue that you might feel weird or different or bloated? Or like obviously we've spoken about like fiber, and obviously too much fiber and too much fat might make you feel like your digestion is a little bit slower or sluggish or bloating or whatever. But just like the sugar on its own, like we always hear that having too much sugar gives you these sugar crashes and like energy spikes, and then you drop down. Are you going to feel like that going into your race, or are you still eating enough whole foods that it's just not really an issue?
Yeah. So from a few angles, like one thing that you didn't fully say, but I'll address this as well, like body composition. Like you can't ruin your body composition in a day. I think that's the biggest fear that a lot of people have. Like a lot of people will, I don't want to say mask it with these other concerns, but like that is the biggest fear. But getting too into the numbers here, but like a kilo of body fat is made up of 7,000 calories. Mm-hmm. Like you can't add a kilo of body fat in a single day. Whereas like I think people have this fear that they like do this one day and they'll gain heaps of body fat. So it's like, okay, that physically cannot happen. And then read between the lines as well in terms of the next day of being like, I just said that if you do this, you're going to run out of glycogen stores. Even if you maximize things in 90 minutes, like you're still going to run out of glycogen stores. Marathon runners hit the wall at around that 90 minute mark. This is one of the things that stops people from getting past that 2 hour mark consistently in race conditions or anything like that. So it's like you're burning through this by definition anyway. So that's one thing. In terms of the other things, the crashes, I've heard so many people say that, and I believed that for so long, but one thing that is interesting is if you actually got somebody like measuring their blood glucose levels, it's actually really rare. Like having heaps of sugar doesn't make many people go hypoglycemic. Like there is a case of reactive hypoglycemic that does happen in some situations. It's rare, it does happen. But average person, give them a bunch of sugar, their blood glucose levels raise, insulin gets released, which takes it back down to the healthy level. And at some stage, insulin stops getting released and it just like sits in the healthy level. Like it's clearly not an issue. And that's also why I come back to that performance thing, being like, I'd heard people say that, I believe that, I was worried about that mechanism. I see a lot of people in the running space talk about this as well. They even talk about like having gels in the race causing that like crash and everything like that. But the simplest way to come back to that as well is being like, we're seeing improved race times by this. Like we're seeing that when people are having firstly that carb load and also carbs before the training session or the race, and then carbs during the race coming from sugar, their race times are improving, which I think makes that simpler.
So we've got 15 minutes left, and I would love to get to our listener questions at some point. But I would suggest that our listeners go and check out your Instagram to see your carb loading plan individually. They can get a bit of an understanding about what you're doing. And just one more thing about your own individual Gold Coast prep. What are you taking on race day? What are you going to have during, and I guess on the morning of?
So morning of, like, I'm just going to have like a similar breakfast to what I've currently been doing, which is just like oats. I switched to quick oats for that though, so it'll be lower fiber or easier to digest, to be specific. It'll be like protein oats, just because that's just what I do. Just keeping things the same. If I feel good, why not change it? I shouldn't change it, I should say. I'll have beetroot juice, as I've spoken about. I have caffeine, so normally just like on a standard run, I've just been having a single shot of coffee before the run. On that day, I'm going to have the equivalent of 4 shots of coffee, but that's obviously something that I've also practiced in other events, like with powerlifting and stuff like that. I've practiced that. I know it goes well, so that's fine, even though I haven't done it for running. Gels throughout the day. So I will be having 5 gels throughout the run. So like, I think I'll be done in an hour and a half. So do the maths on that, like whatever that comes out as. I believe it might be like 70 grams of carbs per hour from the top of my head. When I originally did the maths, I assumed I was going to be a lot slower than I am. And I did a different amount of gels. So I haven't actually done the maths on the new gels. What else? One of my gels will have some caffeine in it, and I'll use that like halfway through as well.
Nice. Sounds good.
Oh, actually, the other thing I did miss, sorry, is there will be water there, which I'll be having, and there'll also be, they have a drink, I can't remember what it was called. I did look up the nutrition as well, which I factored into my overall carbs too.
That's awesome. I think we should get into some listener questions. What do you think, Soph?
Yes, let's do it. Question from Alice.
Beautiful. So Alice Barty asked, should fuel choices change depending on if we're doing cardio runs or strength/weights?
Yeah, very much so. In terms of like intra workout, like I don't really think many people need intra workout when they're lifting. Complex topic, just to chuck some numbers out there. 6 sets of leg extensions to failure has been shown to reduce glycogen stores by like 40%. And when you hear a number like that, it makes you think, being like, well, if somebody's relatively well-fueled, how many sets of each muscle group are they doing in a single session? Are they really going to get depleted of glycogen? And if they do get depleted of glycogen, it's towards the back end of their session, does it also matter? Like, will that stop them from being able to build muscle at an optimal rate, particularly if they train to the same proximity of failure? So it's like in the session, it's like in most cases, people don't really need stuff. Keep in mind, I also work with like a lot of powerlifters who are doing like 2-hour sessions, but they also rest a lot between sets as well. If they're well-fueled, like probably not an issue. In some cases, if somebody feels better, I'll have them having something during it. Obviously with running in intra-workout makes sense. In terms of like the rest of the stuff, protein for lifting, I go higher, but if somebody's like a hybrid athlete and they're doing both, I would just use the same amount of protein every day, including running days, lifting days, rest days. Protein needs remain unchanged on rest days. The thing that I would change more is just total carbohydrate. If somebody's doing more work, as in they're burning through more stuff, I'll have higher carbohydrate intake. If somebody's doing less, I'll lower their carbohydrates. Even on rest days, I wouldn't go necessarily super low calorie or anything like that. I don't even try to match it one for one, being like if somebody burns 1,000 calories in a run and I don't give them 1,000 calories extra on that day and then 1,000 calories less when they're resting, because of a few reasons. One, it actually just doesn't matter that much. And two, they'll be very hungry on their rest day if we do it that way. So even on rest days, calories are still a decent amount in most cases.
Yeah, awesome. Very good. Hopefully that answers Alice's question. We'll move on to a question from Pascal. When to eat after fasted cardio? He said immediately after, or is it better to wait a few minutes or maybe longer?
Yeah. So I assume it means longer, but yeah. I... So
the two options are quite similar.
Yeah. But I, there's no need to wait. Like, I don't really think there is any additional benefit of being fasted anyway. Complex topic, but there's even this concept called train high, sleep low, which is like, say somebody's training 2 times in a day each day, they could do 1 session in a high glycogen state and 1 session in a low glycogen state. Like, they might go to bed without having eaten any carbs, train fast the next day, so they're in a low carb state, and then the next session they could eat heaps of carbs before that, be in a high carb state. Some people have like hypothesized that could be like best of both worlds. That could be like, you get some of the advantages that some people would get from training a low carb state, such as improved fat oxidation, maybe some improved mitochondrial efficiencies. There's a bunch of potential benefits that somebody could get, but you still train the ability to be able to take on carbs so that when race day comes, you can maximize a carb load and take on heaps of carbs while running. But that hasn't been shown to be any better. That's been studied. It's been studied for a while. It hasn't been shown to be any better. And since we know about the benefits of carbs and everything like that, I'm like, I don't see any additional benefit of doing fasted cardio to start off with, unless it's just a preference and you just want to do that. And that I totally understand. But because I don't see the benefit there, it's like, I don't see the benefit in waiting after. It just makes sense to refuel as soon as makes sense.
That probably then brings us on to our next two questions from two separate listeners around fats and different fuel sources. Jack Williams asks if there's an advantage, the question is a bit more of a statement, fat burning as fuel sources for long events.
Yeah. So there's a great statement from Louise Burke, who she's done a lot of research that has, like, she's basically just compared like low carb versus low carb versus high carb diets for endurance performance. And like every single study she's done has come out in favor of high carb, often smaller benefits than you'd think, but it's come out in favor. And there's a statement from hers I really love that is, if something works, I want to know about it. Because obviously everybody in the low carb community will criticize her. Like they'll just find flaws in her studies. Like the most famous study she's done is like, it's called the Supernova Trial. And they used race walkers who, because they're walking, not running, like they actually have a higher percentage of their fuel is coming from fat than from runners. And even in that study, the higher carb diets outperformed. Louise Burke was kind of talking about how like she figured it was due to like the more intense parts of the walk, like if they're going up hills or whatever, there's a small advantage for higher carbs there. And a lot of people criticize that was too short in duration. It was only 3 weeks. Maybe fat adaptation takes longer and everything like that. And it's tough to quantify that because fat adaptation based on every metric that we've seen comes pretty quickly. But the point I was getting at is like, everyone thinks she's got bias, but she's like, just like this, I've just put the study together and this is what's happened. Like, and if working with elite athletes, it makes sense to do that. One of the areas where it becomes more interesting is really long endurance events. Like we very clearly see like marathon distance and stuff like that, like higher carb diets are outperforming. Like that's been studied to death. It's clear cut. But the longer the event gets, the more I can see an argument for using fat as fuel. One of the most obvious arguments is that we have an abundance of fat on our body in terms of calories. Even if somebody only had 5 kilos of body fat, I touched on a number earlier being a kilo of body fat has 7,000 calories. Like the average person can store like, I don't know, like 500 to 700 grams of glycogen, which each contains 4 calories per grams. I know I'm using too much mass there, but it's like, that means people have a maximum of like 2000 calories of glycogen that they can burn through. If somebody has 5 times 7,000, like 35,000 calories of fat on them, it's just like an endless supply, even for people who are lean, like it's still an endless supply. And since, as I said, around that 90 minute kind of mark, even if you do a full carb load and you're taking on gels throughout and everything like that, you're still running low on glycogen at that state if you're running at a decent pace and everything like that. The longer the event gets, the less of a difference that advantage will make. And you can see an argument for that. This is also another separate argument as to why women are very close to men over very long distances, because women are slightly more efficient at burning fat than men, or fat oxidization. Like I was looking up the world records for like Ironman triathlons, and like the difference between women and men is like, it's so close. It's like the longer the duration gets of events, like the closer that becomes just due to that change in fat oxidation.
Oh, super interesting. I'd love to talk to you more about that. But we will keep moving on. That also answers Jordan Murray's question as well, which is really helpful. Final question for the night is from Blake Withers, who also has a podcast, which you can check out as well. He asks, what adaptations occur when you train your stomach to take on nutrition?
Yeah, the super interesting question. Hey, so like you had sent this through to me in advance, and like a lot of these questions I could just like rattle off the top of my head. And in that one, I've just never cared about it. I just care about the outcome, right?
Yeah.
But like the genuine answer is that training the gut, like if you do practice this, do this in training, it improves our ability to oxidize carbs, which is kind of one of those things that, as I was talking about that train high, sleep low kind of concept, the most obvious thing that people thought of initially is like, if low carb states, training in a low carb state has these adaptations, why can't we just go low carb for all of our training and then carb load at the end and then take on heaps of gels like while running? And it just did not work. It just didn't work because people couldn't, one, they couldn't tolerate the gels very well, but two, their ability to oxidize carbs decreased significantly because they weren't taking it on. And so one aspect of this, the first half, is basically training while taking on carbs improves your ability to burn carbs, use it as fuel basically. And because we know it's our best fuel source, that's obvious, that's a benefit. The other one is improvements in gastric emptying and absorption. We tolerate the carbs better and we can take on more because of the body adapting and getting better at gastric emptying. So like the stomach emptying basically. So that's why training, it makes sense.
There you go. Nice. That's Blake will appreciate that. He loves the science and the why behind things. So that was good little info for him and for the listeners as well. One final question, which is very off topic, but your favorite pair of running shoes, what are you going to wear on race day?
Oh, that's where you've lost me, hey. So I've actually made a huge mistake here. So one, it's another thing I just don't care about. And I'm sure I'm sure I could get better results if I didn't care about this. But the issue, so like probably like 3-4 weeks out, I was like, oh, my shoes are getting pretty worn down, and like the soles of them are getting pretty worn down, and then also like the back of it, it's been rubbing and that's like worn down. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to get new shoes, like one just for financial reasons, I just don't like spending money, but the second one is also like I don't want to get new shoes like 2 weeks out from a half marathon and then get like mad blisters while running on the day. And it turns out they've been worn down so much that like I'm getting like blisters on the back of my hands from them being worn down. I've just messed this up.
So what shoes are you gonna wear? Gonna stick with them. Got a few days.
Oh no, I'm just gonna stick them old faithful. Oh, I'll just chuck a band-aid on. I'll be fine.
Oh gosh,
what are they?
I don't want to shame the brand.
It's like
ASICS or something like that. I have not put much effort into that.
I love how much you like know all the details about so many specific topics, but shoes you just don't care about.
Yeah.
Fair enough. It's good. Yeah. Good to be relaxed about that aspect. But no, I'm so excited for you. We're really keen to hear how the race goes. We want a full debrief of every kilometer, every gel. And good luck with it. And thank you so much for your time today. I've learned a lot and I'm sure the listeners have too.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Aiden. That was awesome. There's definitely a lot of value for our listeners to take away. So good luck, and we can't wait to hear how you go.
Cheers.